Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9 here in Prague. Beautiful city.
Yeah, it's lovely here.
For Web Expo 2015, the weather's been super nice, a little overcast today. It's a lot nicer outside.
Yeah, nice fall weather.
Rocking the long sleeve.
Yeah.
So tell us who you are and what you do, bud.
My name's Johnny Rogers. I work at Slack in our Vancouver office, and I work on our front-end team.
Now, Slack is like the new coolness. So tell us what Slack does first.
So Slack is all your team communication in one place. It's a place where if you work on a team and you all spend the majority of your time in front of a computer or with your mobile device, you can use it instead of email, basically. So you spend all your time chatting with your colleagues in Slack. There's channels for different topics that you might be interested in or different projects that you're working on. And it allows you to search over everything that you end up talking about. So it builds an archive of all of your company knowledge.
So that's awesome. So that's really cool. But let's talk a little bit more about your talk. What did you talk about?
Sure. So I was presenting at Web Expo on trade-offs in front-end development. And I talked about how we wrote code at the very beginning of Slack and how we're writing code now that we're a bigger team. We have more customers and millions of people using the product every day. So the main gist of the talk was that early on, we were focused on moving really fast, prototyping quickly. We weren't so concerned with, you know, uptime or anything like that.
Right.
We were allowed to have more volatility in the product because we didn't have customers. You know, we didn't have code review. We didn't use a lot of code tooling or any QA process. And we were, like I said, moving fast, prototyping, proving out the concept, making sure we were building the right product mm-hmm. that people wanted to use. And then fast forward 3 years, through our public launch and through the uptake that we've seen, and now we have, you know, over 100 engineers working on the product, over 20 on front end, and that process has changed a great deal.
Sure.
To maintain safer code, you know, less breakage for our production services, and to make it safer and easier to learn for new devs as they come on board.
So there, it seems like the trade-off you're talking about is speed. And not necessarily versus quality, but versus
stability.
Stability.
Yeah.
So talk about that trade-off a little bit. Can you be fast and stable, or is there you're going to lose some fidelity when you're having to get to minimum viable product as fast as you can?
Yeah, I think, you know, I talk about having that volatility in the early days, and we definitely did. That being said, we were such a small team, and everybody was so dedicated to what we were doing that I think we were actually still even relatively stable at that point.
Of course.
I think you can have that speed and stability, but it demands a lot of the team. You have to, you have to be able to trust everybody on the team 100% that they're going to be responsible for the code that they're committing, that they're going to be on top of it if something goes wrong, and that they're going to have a good idea of what's happening if you're seeing, you know, anomalies. So at that point, we were able to do that. But at the team size that we're at now, and at the number of customers we have, and the number of things that we're doing in parallel, it's just, it's not realistic to expect that, you know, nobody's ever going to make a mistake. So, I mean, we have fantastic engineers, now we have a lot more processes in place in terms of code review, you know, safe deployment processes, postmortems when things go wrong, et cetera, that make it a lot more stable and a lot safer for new devs to come on board and be contributing quickly.
So, I mean, I guess you're saying that with few developers, you can go fast and be stable, but then when you start to get like into the 50s and 60s and hundreds of developers, then there needs to be more rigidity because you're not going to be talking to 100 people every day, but with five or so, you can sort of interact.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So let's talk about some of the front-end development. What kind of stuff do you do to make Slack work? Because it's very fluid, it feels very nice.
Thanks. Well, as I said yesterday in the talk, we actually use a fairly basic stack. It's HTML5, mostly vanilla JavaScript. We use some libraries for different aspects of our front end. We use Less as a preprocessor mm-hmm. for all of our CSS, which works well. And beyond that, there's nothing too exotic going on. We've invested a lot in that HTML5-driven front end because that's what powers our web client, obviously, as well as all of our desktop apps. All of our desktop apps are native wrappers around our web client. You know, that's not everybody's favorite approach, but it's worked really well for us because we have a lot of specialization in web technologies, and it means that we never have to ship new versions to get new features out to people. You know, it's just a reload away. It means we get, you know, good logging and all sorts of, like, nice free stuff from the browser, basically. And, of course, it avoids having to do everything twice across desktop and browser.
So my understanding is that you use the Electron shell to embed sort of the HTML in it. Now, is the Electron shell calling some services in the back end, or is it actually loading up the web page?
It's actually loading up the web page. Now, of course, we've built a lot on top of it to make that desktop experience feel more native. So in our Mac app and in our Windows apps.
Which are the same, incidentally.
They are now. They weren't for a long time. We use calls out to native methods for windowing, some keyboard shortcuts, some sound controls, desktop notifications, that kind of stuff that we get that we don't necessarily get in a browser. You know, Chrome does desktop notifications, but a little bit differently than native and so on. So we're calling out to those methods, and then the web app itself that's embedded is doing all the same stuff that it would be if you loaded it up in the browser. So it's making a connection to our message server, and then it's calling the API async to get any user action data back.
That's awesome. So for those that are getting into front-end development, it seems like Slack is a really good product for showcasing some of the better techniques that you could use. What are some tips you have for those that are new to front-end development? What can they do to learn, and what are some things that they need to know in order to be good at it?
That's a good question. I think it's changing so fast that, you know, my answer today is different from what it would have been a few years ago. I think I talked to you yesterday about how a lot of JavaScript developers today are mostly focused on which framework they're going to use.
I see.
So there's a lot of people sort of saying, you know, this is my paradigm. I'm always going to write apps like this, you know, with an MVC architecture and like the Angular framework for data binding, you know, very much about choosing libraries. And I don't think that's actually necessary. I think you can learn a great deal from frameworks, and by using them to build different projects and using lots of different frameworks, you can figure out the best techniques, because there are a lot of really smart people working on these frameworks. For example, the React UI framework from Facebook and Instagram is fantastic. But I don't think you have to always adopt one of those frameworks. I think you can learn a great deal from them, but then mostly you know, just try things out in JavaScript. The HTML5 and CSS parts of it are pretty straightforward, although CSS is getting more sophisticated all the time. I think a lot of the online tutorials from places like Treehouse and Codecademy and stuff are actually really great, because you can get up and running very quickly. It's the kind of thing that if you're an engineer from another discipline, you'll be able to pick up what's going on very quickly. And if you're brand new, just starting out, it's very step-by-step, and we'll take you along how to put those three pieces together, because basically HTML5 is your markup, CSS is your styling, and JavaScript is your behavior, and you just need to know how those three pieces are interacting. And there's just a wealth of tutorials and stuff that you do pretty high-level stuff very quickly.
So you mentioned that maybe a couple of years ago you would have said something different. Tell us about that evolution in your career as a front-end developer. How did you start out, and sort of what realizations did you have along the way?
Yeah, well, so I've been writing websites since really the late 90s.
Which is when the boom started.
It's when it was happening, right? You know, I was at the right time when, you know, we got a web connection when I was 10 or 11 years old, something like that, and was using, you know, the early, you know, Mosaic and everything to build our web pages.
Wow.
Anyway, so I've seen that evolution.
That's like ancient history, speaking technology-wise.
Right?
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's funny.
I don't feel that old, but I remember that stuff.
And in those early days, you know, you were basically writing just straight HTML. Everything was embedded in that one page, and it was very simple. And then, you know, the browsers started to diverge from each other. We started to have that first sort of browser war, and so you had to manage that. And then it was Internet Explorer. Easy. I'm writing HTML again.
I still remember those buttons, you know, works best on IE4.
Oh,
remember those?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you would, like, brand your page with that, like, yeah, I'm good, I'm set. Anyway, that's a long time ago. Now, you know, sort of with the advent of, I think, really Chrome in the late or mid-2000s, you know, there started to be this much more rapid turnover of browser technology and proliferation of browsers, you know, Firefox and Safari and Chrome and Internet Explorer. And you started to have to manage this very inconsistent implementations of JavaScript and CSS and everything else. And it was a nightmare, and there was a long period where you were just having to do a lot of manual checking and testing and, you know, hacks for these different browsers to make sure that they worked properly. I think a lot of that in the last few years, or the last 5-7 years, something like jQuery makes a lot of those go away, which is fantastic. It's very easy to get up and running. And these preprocessors for CSS that do things like manage all those proprietary prefixes for you, that makes it a lot easier. And that have shims for the various advanced effects that you might want to do. So things like transitions and transforms, gradients, all this kind of stuff. So I think, you know, what it might have been like 5 years ago with that very manual process of a lot of checking. Like I can remember my web dev setup being having, you know, four browsers up at a time, refreshing them all, seeing if everything was working. This is when I was doing client work. And now for the most part, you don't have to worry about that. I mean, something like Slack, we do have to do cross-browser testing to make sure things are right, but the inconsistencies now tend to be very minimal. You know, a little pixel shift here or there, or, you know, one particular JavaScript method that we need to make sure we have a polyfill for. Mm-hmm. For the most part now, I know most of our devs are using, you know, either Chrome or Firefox full-time, but we know it's going to run just fine in the new versions of IE. It's going to run just fine in Safari.
Are you finding that the browser wars are kind of in the past and now the war is on speed?
That's an interesting way to put it. It does seem like there's lots of room for these different browsers. I mean, people choose them for different reasons. If you're on Linux, you're going to choose one thing. On Microsoft, you're going to choose another. And that's okay. I mean, like I said, they're all compatible enough now. You know, it's still kind of this friction point for web devs. You always have to deal with it. But it's not nearly as bad as it used to be. Now there's a lot of room for competition on mostly speed, mostly performance. Some different features that they allow you to do around, you know, your profiles or dev tools are actually a big one. I know I choose Chrome because the dev tooling is just very familiar and comfortable and powerful. It seems to be speed. And we see that in Slack a lot. We do performance timing across different browsers, and we see some surprising things. You know, the same action might take significantly less time on one browser than another, and then we'll dig into the guts of that and try and figure out why, and it just has to do with differences in the rendering engines.
That's cool.
And which things that the different engines optimize for. For example, Safari seems to really heavily optimize for like silky smooth visual transitions, but then Chrome seems to do a better job at, you know, calculating data.
And that's interesting because now it's not a question of in between browsers making sure the div is lining up.
Right.
Now it's like, how fast is this and why is it faster here versus the other?
Exactly. Yeah, so I'm definitely not an expert in the guts of the browser, why that is the way it is, but it's very interesting when you start digging into that stuff. I mean, we're talking hundreds of milliseconds difference, you know, it's still, they're all very fast. But when you add that up, or when you, you know, are really asking like a large single page application like Slack to do a lot of heavy work, those hundreds of milliseconds make a big difference to the user experience.
So to finish up, I know your talk was about trade-offs in front-end development. Mm-hmm. I think the best thing to do is when you come to a trade-off to make a decision. Mm-hmm. So what is the biggest trade-off in your opinion that we have to confront head-on and say, okay, we're going to have to go this way and we're going to make an informed decision about it?
I think, you're making these decisions every day, and maybe it's about committing to a particular technology choice to solve the problem that you're working on, or maybe it's about a process that you and your team are going to agree on, you know, that you're going to do things a certain way or follow a certain pattern. I think, you know, you make the best decision with the information you have at the time, obviously. And when you do have a big team, there are a lot of different opinions, right? You know, people who have very good reasons for selecting a certain thing. Maybe they're familiar with the library, maybe they've seen something succeed before, something fail before, you know, how they did it at their old job. And so there's a lot of different, you know, useful inputs there, but at the end of the day, you gotta get 20 people writing the same code base and being able to maintain it. You know, you try and come to some consensus and recognize different people's points of view and different technology alternatives and what the trade-offs are, and then you move forward. You select one, and you know, those who are in leadership on your team are going to have to select something, move forward, and then build things in a way and keep your process flexible to the point where if it turns out in 3 months that was the wrong choice or you'd be better served by something, just switch. Yeah, just stay flexible, always move forward, don't get too caught up in any kind of idealistic talk of the perfect way to do something, because there isn't a perfect way, there's just many ways. Just continue to always be assessing your options because they're always changing.
I guess there really is no biggest trade-off because it depends on the project you're working on.
It really does. Yeah, you might be in a position where you really need to optimize for speed, and so you're going to make choices around that. You know, you're going to write your JavaScript a certain way, you're going to choose certain libraries, and you're going to have a certain process. Maybe that's if you're a startup or if you're in a type of product where performance is the most important thing. But there are many other ways that you might go about it.
Well, sweet. Thanks so much for spending some time with us, bud.
Pleasure talking to you.
It's awesome to have Johnny Rogers here. We're at Web Expo 2020 in Prague. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time. Take care.